Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, you beautiful people.
Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
And our producer, Mr. Awesome himself, Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. I'm Bryce, Mr. Awesome Castillo.
Yeah, he loves it when you call him that, by the way. You're like, oh my God, it's Mr. Awesome.
It's a good name. It's a good nickname. It's like a generic, what is it, Fantastic Four.
Guy. Well, and of course, my code name is awesome. Is Dr. Bee's Knees.
Not like James Flame or something.
No, you don't want to be on.
Okay.
And I'm kid. Okay.
Gentlemen, you know, we had a discussion right before the show about glamping tents, things like this, and I have an idea.
Yeah. Is it that you want to glamp in a tent?
Yeah, I don't quite fully know what it means, but I'm but, sure.
Glamping is basically like you're camping, but it's like high-end luxury. You know, you got heaters, space heaters and air conditioners and your own toilet. And
You know the joke about going out camping, but then there's like a TV there? That's pretty much glamping.
Yeah.
It's like a spa day.
See, that's the thing is that's what I've just understood as camping. Like I'm going out into the world. Like I don't know a world in which I'm not bringing my laptop and I'm trying to bring many of the comforts of the modern world out into nature.
Well, and so now there's finally a word for it. You've always been glamping. Now there's a word for it.
True story. When I was in the Boy Scouts, we went on a camping trip, and for me, you know, I'm kind of a nocturnal person, right? So the idea of like, you know, 2 hours after lights out, you know, the sun's down, being in our tent and, you know, doing whatever didn't sound appealing to me. And I asked my scoutmaster, like, are we allowed to build our own tent? He's like, yeah, you can build your own tent. I'm like, okay. So I brought some tarps and stuff, and I brought a little more stuff than maybe the other scouts brought.
Nice.
And and I built my own little tent. And imagine the point of view from my scoutmaster. He's walking along. It's very quiet. You know, the fire's down, just the tents, maybe some flashlights. And he sees this blue glow coming from one tent. And I hear this, you know, on the fabric. Andrew, what's that? And he opens up, and there I am watching my TV. Right. Now, this is when I'm a teenager. I'm like 14. So this TV meant like a kind of like a 1 foot by 1 foot cube, black and white battery operated TV. And I'm sitting there just watching TV. It's like, this isn't what camping's about. I'm like, it's portable. He's like, no. And he looks in there and I've got one of these like refrigerated coolers where I'm like drinking a soda out of. He's like, no. You're like, coming with me.
And you're like, you're right. I thought it was overkill. I should have just used the fountain soda dispenser.
So he made me spend the rest of the night sitting on the floor of his tent. He was a very good scoutmaster, but he lived with his mom and there was sort of this question about him. So I spent the night in the corner kind of frightened. nothing happened. But it was a very, very interesting experience. Whereas maybe scouts and me weren't meant to be together.
Hey, yeah, I'm not down with this. I mean, I don't know. For anybody who does like to rough it and they like to have the thing and be one with nature, or whatever. Like that's fine. I always found that to be a little bit artificial. Like nature really wants to kill you. Like I have no interest in just laying in the jaws of a lion and acting like me and the lion are super cool.
Nature.
It's just sleepy.
Great place to visit. Wouldn't want to live there.
Yeah.
On the subject of camping or experimental camping, what if we decided to do some research, like build our own self-contained enclosed environment, seal it off, put some plants in there for some oxygen, and, you know, basically build our own little mini-contained ecosystem, like a biodome, but a small-scale one-man one.
Okay. Did we ever talk about – we must have talked about this in the past. Did you guys ever visit Biosphere 2, the ill-fated scientific research place? My brother and I – when I graduated high school, I was like, I want to go on a trip to the West Coast to go visit my aunt and uncle and cousins. And my brother, you know, being, I think he was entering his junior year of high school. So we just drove out, and then we saw, and this is, again, pre-internet. Like, I had only read in magazines about Biosphere 2, this completely enclosed, encapsulated attempt to take all 7 or 8 ecosystems and represent them or whatever. The brave scientists who were going to try to survive on their own fertilizer. and as we're driving out there, we see next exit Biosphere 2. I was like, you gotta be kidding me. And I told my brother all about it, and he's like, yeah. And so we spent, you know, I think it was about $100 we didn't have to go on the full tour and do everything. And at the time, you know, it ended up being an ill-fated experiment, and sort of the salvaged remains of it are, well, we learned a lot about how hard it is to do this kind of thing for when we go to Mars. But at the time, it was hard not to get swept up into this sense of visionary. It was like there's what Epcot became, and there's what Walt Disney intended Epcot to be, right? And Epcot ended up being fine, but he had a very different vision. And it was like, we got to glimpse that original vision of Biosphere 2. It was crazy.
I remember when they first did it, and the participants, you know, had like these space shuttle like uniforms as they went inside of Biosphere 2. And to their credit, it was like a legit, like, we're really going to seal ourselves off as long as we possibly can and try to see how it works. There was a lot of politics. I mean, a lot of like infighting, whatever, among the whole plan, whatever. Yeah, they look like the people from the TV show V, where the aliens, you know, came to Earth to eat people.
Those are the V costumes.
Yes. But it was, you know, it was a very interesting idea. I would say that my criticism was, and this is just retrospect looking in, they had a couple, I think, what I recall, kind of flawed premises. And one of them was they way overestimated the how much CO2 the plants could absorb, and that was the problem they had, was continuing oxygen depletion. And there were other, you know, there were things that seemed like, man, it would have been neat to try this for like a few days at a time and build up and then try to then go through. But it seemed like they had this whole theory, this is how it'll work, and it didn't work. There were a lot of problems there, and then it sort of fell apart.
Well, if we want to put a charitable shine on everything, you know, we've talked about in After Things how highly competitive artistic markets, a lot of people enter the fray and fail, and each of their failures subsidizes the ultimate success. Yes, they totally failed at their mission of figuring out a sustainable, you know, model for a space arc or whatever, but their failure subsidized a lot of things. I suspect that for many years to come, it's good to know what is harder than you think. And I thank you for your service, Biosphere 2, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I would say yes, and, but I'd say there are people who told them at the beginning, this is the problem, and maybe stage it. Like, fail often, not fail once and then be done. And that would be my crit, would be like, hey, there are people who are telling you this would be the problem. You're like, no, we got this. And like, hey, turned out the exact thing that people said was going to happen happened. And I think building, and I agree, I love the fact they're ambitious to try this. I love that. But I think it's sort of this, well, account for this, and maybe you could have made it more sustainable. I'm easy for me to be like armchair, we should have done this, but that was what people said. Like, your auction, this is not going to work. It's not going to work. And then it didn't work. And then we lost an opportunity to be like, there are a lot of, we did learn some stuff, but could have learned a lot more.
I think that might be the indictment, is that we, yes, if we gained all that from one big failure, right? Like, how much more could we have gained if we had just a lot of little failures or tweaks along the way that as you stage up to people going there full time?
Well,
just a little button on this. Again, I want to be charitable because I'm a fan of people who want to do crazy things. In some alternate universe, Epcot, because Epcot, I think, also, as it was originally envisioned, was doomed to failure. But instead, they figured out, oh, wait, no, we're just going to be an attraction. Like, I can imagine a sideways universe where Biosphere Fever took over and they had roller coasters and it was the raddest place to come watch people in a bubble or to contemplate that pro-science minded experiment. And I commend them for their attempt.
I want more of these attempts. And hey, somebody heard me. What is this? Curtis Bowd decided he was going to do a one-man biosphere. He was going to close himself inside of his own. And this was to raise awareness about climate change. I'm not sure what the overall thing he was trying to make aware of, but he decided, hey, I'm going to seal myself inside on his, like, I guess his brother and sister-in-law's farm. He put himself inside this clear plastic tent with a lot of plants and stuff. And the goal was just, I guess, to go 3 days or so in a totally a realistically self-contained system. There was like double wall chambers. I think he used like positive air pressure or whatever to do this. Somebody in a comment section says, I believe a scientist just attempted something like this. So you can read the coverage of when he decided to go do this, you know, and it's like, oh, it's cool. Kind of a neat experiment. He made it 15 hours. And
wait,
then
before it became like super dangerous?
Yeah. He 14 hours in the 10 by 10 cube, he had to stop because the CO2 meter said, hey, guess what? These plants that you're counting on to replenish your oxygen supply, not enough.
Wow.
But you know, the thing is, like, he spent the time in there to show how greenhouse gases are suffocating the earth. He was the only person producing them.
Yes. But I would imagine his point would be, yeah, and I proved it. It's really a problem.
Nailed it.
There are too many greenhouse gases.
CO2 interferes with respiration. I'm glad, you know, we ignored 100 years of research on that to decide that this is a new discovery.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. This picture just tickled me. He's just so excited. He's so thrilled.
Well, I mean, if I'm reading your take, Andrew, is that there's a bit of an eye rolling, well, duh, to this. And yet, you know, we genuinely have a bit of an academic crisis happening right now in that that we're having problems with reproducibility of academic experiments. Right. Mm-hmm. And so even if the answer is, well, duh, I kind of want to high five this dude too for proving the obvious again.
I spent several days doing rebreather training, right? Learning, you know, how to use a rebreather, how to recycle your own oxygen, all this sort of stuff. And the math is pretty simple. And then you look at plants, things like this. And I guess my thing is like, yeah, I think these things are cool, but it's like, dude, you could have done the math and you would have known. You know, there was not a lot of scientific rigor. My problem is that, and I would like to see more of these. I would like to see more of these experiments because I think if we want to live on Mars and other places, we got to figure this out. But, you know, the people who are kind of jumping in and saying, well, I don't need to do the math or the science because that really matter because I'm trying to make a point. It's like, you're not maybe doing as much as he doesn't care about, as far as I know, colonization of the planet. It's probably against, I don't know. My point is it's like, do a little research, do a little science, listen to some experts on this, start from there. Don't decide you need to reinvent everything. Maybe it would have been successful because it would have been cool. It would have been really neat to see if this guy maybe had to be twice the volume because trying to live off purely oxygen alone in such a small environment, I'm not aware. There's some NASA research. I'm not aware of it's been. I would love to see this. But I'm like, if you just decide, man, textbooks, things like this, I don't need that. I'm making a point. It's like, well, probably going to fail, but.
Well, I mean, but at a certain point, where does it go from I'm trying to do a public scientific demonstration to this is jackass, like where it's like, and to me, look, I love both, like get you a man who can do both. But like at the same time, it does kind of have to be one or the other. Either it's like I'm going to try to do this thing that is hard to do, if not impossible. Or I'm going to try and to the best of every possible ability figure out where I am scientifically to push forward, use my own human ingenuity to push forward on something that we already know.
Yeah, the what's funny is I want even more weekend people to have failed experiments just like this, assuming nobody ever gets hurt. But I think you could make a case that he gobbled up a lot of the media attention oxygen, and as a result, it's harder for somebody who intends to do a more rigorous, serious approach to this, to get the same attention that he did.
I think everybody should be free to do whatever you want, call whatever you want, and do that. But if your long term goal, and that was one of the criticisms against the biosphere, you call it biodome like the movie, but biosphere too, was that it made it much harder to get researcher funding for this because, and again, it's like, and it's, that's the world we live in. You know, I did something, I failed, and we should be free to fail. We absolutely need to be free to fail and all that. But because that failed in a way that it did, and maybe they, it could, somebody else could have a much better chance succeeding, it's harder to get funding for it. And just a thing to be mindful is like, all right, have I covered my bases? You know, but I am talking to a guy who does make a large part of his living doing the show, doing very stupid stuff. So.
Well, and plus, I think Beef Viper has the right of what I'm trying to discover in myself as I extrovert through this. Beef Viper writes, "Hey man, without the math, it's just performance art." To which my you know magician brain thinks, "Yeah, I'm okay with that too. like I'm cool with all sides of this. Do the math, get it right, have it work, have it not work, great, science. Also, if do no math, it's performance art. Fan of that,
and,
too.
And let's not say let's not say he didn't do no math. Like, this I don't know.
Bryce, you're correct.
Right.
When I heard it was the size of the chamber and I heard he was planning to do this, I was surprised because of what I as a performance artist and not a scientist, know about CO2 absorption sure. up. I'm like, that doesn't sound like, you know, I'm like, how long, that doesn't sound sustainable, you know, and then, well, you know, and then, and so I'm like, this guy's got a science channel, just like, I assume he knows more than I do.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and to sort of round up the story, I think he only was trying to survive in here like 24 hours and he was not expecting the overcast weather to affect.
I think he was trying to go for 3 days, but yeah, I think there's, yeah, a lot of them, you know. Well,
yeah,
I would love for him to go do this again with a bigger with right. you know better CO2 absorbing plants, things like this. I would love to see him try this again and try to beat what he did. I would be very enthusiastic, and if he can find a way to make this work, I will be championing. Hey, look, this is really cool what he did.
I think look, and it seemed like it's something that he really wanted to make a big deal about, and obviously made a big enough deal that we're talking about it here on the show. But yeah, look, this is the beautiful era that we are in, where there is no, you don't have to wait for like Brian mentioned that like the media coverage came and now it might not come for another thing. In this day and age, look, to do it on YouTube, to do it on Twitter, to do it on Facebook is its own reward. And it is something that can connect you with an audience that would otherwise find you. And there is no judgment. There's no gatekeeper to say, well, wait, another weirdo in a clear tent. We just covered that. We just spilled our ink on that one last week. That's definitely a newspaper term.
You know what else
their
is
their policy? No weirdo and biodome stories. Haven't you read it?
Yeah, listen. No, don't bring that story to me. We already covered it. See, I speak in rhymes.
All right, listen up, kids. It's time for our staff meeting. I know it's the mid-20th century, but the good news is we have a total monopoly on how people get their information. It's not like in the future anybody can be an independent creator. I mean, what are they going to do? How are they going to sell the ads that we sell? Ha ha!
I know. We're trying to sell advertisements to dance marathons. That's the way that this business keeps afloat. Not like there's a website called patreon.com/weirdthings where independent creators can continue to make sure that they make a living by way of the donations directly from their audience.
Oh,
see?
Man. Yeah. Well, see, here's the thing, kid. Even if that did exist, I'll bet once a month as everybody gets collected and some of the credit cards are declined, there'll be a huge dip. It's unsustainable. The only way it could possibly be sustained is if people were to take a moment and double check their pledges and make sure that they were able to get us enough money. I mean, get whoever would use this service that doesn't exist 30 or 50 years from now the money.
50? Only 50 years?
So 70, 80 years from now.
Over 100.
Hey, listen up, Newsy. Get back out on the streets. Sell those newspapers.
Yeah, see, and by the way, if, maybe this site in the future, see, maybe switch their processing partner to one in of old foggy London town, see? And maybe you need to make sure that it doesn't get rejected as a foreign transaction. So please work with your credit card or bank to make sure that your pledge went through, see?
Yeah, but luckily we'll never have to worry about this because we're newspapers. We'll be here forever.
We turn into bats.
Patreon.com/weirdthings.
If you want to see us do our own biodome experiment and sealing Bryce inside of a plastic chamber.
Yes. Bryce, how long do you think you could go in the biodome?
how long could I survive in a biodome?
Yeah, listen, we're loading all the anime you want. Don't worry.
I could probably last a while. I don't eat too much. I think I could probably last maybe a week.
Week and a half, maybe?
Maybe a week.
Week? Yeah. Like a month or something?
Like a week or a week and a half.
Like a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that? I don't know. The problem with trying to talk Bryce into going into a biodome is he better be able to switch the show. Like, we can't really, as funny as it would be to put Bryce in a biodome, he still actually needs to shoot and edit everything. So I guess you and Jason, Brian, you'd have to go and shoot Modern Rogue in his biodome.
The good news is I think the podcast would be unaffected, right? Because we're already planning where the switching station is, where the sets are going to be set up. So we'll just.
But that's
sure
also not in a bio. That's not in a bio.
What if we put Bryce, like, there's the John Travolta movie, The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. What if we put him inside of, like, that spacesuit thing? We give him a tube that connects to the biodome?
Well, oh, yeah. So here's what I'm picturing. There's two biodomes, okay? There's one in the studio, but then there's, like, a doggy door that goes.
What? I can't have a human door.
There's, like, that's where you can get your sunshine and your oxygen from the plants and play.
Exactly. So one of them is not even outside.
Yeah.
I mean, no, you got to be able to come in and switch, though, right?
Yeah.
I might as well do that outside.
I mean, listen, Bryce, it's going to be a very quick 2-3 months.
Yeah, the following 6 months after that will go really fast because the first 2 or 3 months will be the most stressful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when we make it a permanent position.
But I want a human-sized door, do David.
Okay, fine.
tune in New Year's Day as Bryce enters his 2019 biodome, for which he will stay in the entire calendar year.
Tony B.
The Bryce in the plastic bubble.
Yeah, Tony B. Casty. The B stands for biodome.
Oh, jeez.
Do you ever see that John Travolta movie?
Boy in the Bubble?
Tony B.
Boy in the Plastic Bubble, yeah.
No, but I saw the... What was... They remade it?
No. I think you're thinking of the comedy Bubble Boy from the late 90s.
Yeah, same thing.
Yeah. No. The Boy in the Plastic Bubble was... I believe it was David, the Bubble Boy. He had a severe autoimmune disease and could never be let out of his bubble. And they thought that he was well enough to get out of the bubble, and he wasn't. And it's very sad. Although I remember at that time watching on Nickelodeon, I think they ran a show called What Will They Think of Next or something. And basically they had made a literal spacesuit for kids who have similar autoimmune diseases that they could walk outside.
Did they just like soft remake this as like a YA, another like YA thing? I think I remember seeing a commercial or trailer for, I'm sure it was an adaptation of a YA book or whatever, but it was like a girl, she doesn't have a bubble. They ditched the bubble.
Oh, the one with like Patrick Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, where it's like, so it's like a cute boy next door falls in love via like text message and emails with the girl next door who can never leave her house. And
I
then,
think she had a sun allergy or something, like a photo.
Something like that, yeah, where it's like she can't leave, and then she leaves, and I don't know, in the trailer everything starts going wrong. But it seemed like one of them like this if you cry every time kind of stories.
Yeah. It's sad. Autoimmune disease kind of sucks.
Yeah.
Segue from that, guys.
Goblins. Yeah. How are they doing?
Yeah.
Well, you know... Goblins could be one possible explanation to the next interesting thing I have to talk. Presumably interesting. I don't want to tell you what you can find interesting.
Don't want to oversell it.
You know, just when you think like a story's done and the weirdness has been explained away, somebody else comes along and goes, aha, but there is more weirdness. Remember Oumuamua?
Oh, man. For a second, I thought you were going to.
Jeez.
I don't.
Come on, Brian. Like, yeah, that was your favorite thing.
No, I mean, I thought Tub Thumping was good, but I don't remember any other songs.
You know,
Justin, set him straight.
Well, Brian, you can get it, right? Like, you know, so just tell us what your first thought with Oumuamua was.
I already made my Chumbawamba joke. I got nothing
all
left
right,
in there.
Right. But just all right. So then, sure. Go ahead.
These times we live in, when some strange interstellar object comes into our solar system, and we just sort of go,
and immediately starts threatening the Thundercats.
No, that's different. Remember that object that we're like, what is this? What is this thing?
Oh yeah, no, the thing the
space
that looks
dookie.
A little bit
like
a space,
there,
space
dookie
object.
Yeah.
So this object, you know, appeared and saw in our solar system, and we decided this thing probably came from another solar system, whatever, and it had what may have been some interesting, you know, behaviors as far as in relation to, like, you know, to like a Keplerian orbit or how it was sort of behaving. And there was this initial speculation, like, hey, this could be a space probe, man. It's going to be a space probe. I'm like, no, that's stupid. We live in the real world, you know, where there's only one planet with life in the trillions of star systems in our universe, you know. Yeah. Stop this with your rational thinking. Anyhow, I mean, it is kind of absurd. But anyhow, there was that speculation of, like, oh, maybe it's, you know, this and that. And they're like, no, it's not. And, you know, we kind of got, you know, some better telemetry of it and this and that. And so we kind of said, it's probably like a comet or something, whatever, or out of tail, whatever. And it just seemed like we had a good rational explanation for it. Well, some researchers said, you know, there is this question of, it seemed like it had an unusual acceleration profile. And so Shmuel Biley and Abraham Loeb, the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, published a paper, and it's available in archive right now. And they say this is the first object of interstellar origin observed in the solar system, and that the Oumuamua showed deviations from a Keplerian orbit at a high statistical significance, meaning that it behaved a little bit unusual, something that sounds like maybe outside of what we'd expect. The observed trajectory is best explained by an excess radial acceleration, and there's a formula there. So basically what they're saying is that, like, you get into the sort of the, we explore the possibility excess acceleration results from solar radiation pressure. Basically, they say they think it could have hit a solar sail, that the thing could be a probe with a solar sail.
What? I guess the right phrase is non-zero possibility, right? We are seeing something that is consistent. If this is that object, these are, oh my goodness, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
That's astonishing.
So wait, are they like watching us right now?
Could be.
What's going on, man? Hey, what's up, guys? It's me, your boy, Justin Robert Young. Yeah. You want to sub to my Twitch channel?
Hey, listen, I was always for you guys.
Just let it be known who talked directly to you first.
That was Brian making fun of those V uniforms, those biosphere
exactly.
people.
We thought they were cool. Oh my God. Brian kept making fun of your name, saying that you were Chumbawamba. Like, it was great.
Man, yeah. I guess
true fact, gingers taste the best. It's the rest of us are poison.
This is one of those, like, because it's going to pass through the solar system and we're not going to have a chance to know what's what. I mean, unless it, you know, slides into our global DMs and gets into our orbit.
There is that, like, oh, there's been a change, the change in orbit. What? You know, in every science fiction movie, that's a thing. So, you know, these are credible, as far as I know, people making a, hey, like, let's not throw out the possibility that
this is some kind of probe.
This is the Fermi paradox, where it's like, okay, if life is so likely in the universe, how come we ain't seen none? And at some point, if there is life in the universe everywhere, and theoretically, as Michio Kaku described, a type 3 civilization, they probably would have the resources to just fling out a bunch of probes and just be all like, yeah, it's going to take a really long time to get this data, but, you know, we have transcended time and space and have a boundless economy and harvest all the energy from stars, so let's get started.
So they write, yet despite its close solar approach, 0.25 AU, which is a quarter of the distance to the Earth from the sun, Oumuamua shows no sign of any cometary activity, no cometary tail, nor gas emissions absorption lines were observed. From a theoretical point of view, has shown that if outgassing sponsor acceleration as originally proposed, then the associated outgassing torque would have driven a rapid evolution Oumuamua spin which is incompatible with observation. They're saying that, like, hey, we said this thing goes, ah, it's a comet, but it's not doing comet stuff. It's not doing what comets are supposed to do.
So I guess this is how, if and when we ever really confirm alien life, this might be the kind of thing that it looks like, where, you know, we get a story, we roll our eyes, we get another story, we raise an eyebrow, get another story, and then and my guess is even if we got enough data to say, like, no, this is the single most anomalous thing we've ever seen enter our solar system ever, also it'll be gone and we can't catch it, then all of a sudden, you know, 5 years, we start, you know, sending up more and more telescopes and satellites to try to catch the next one of these that we hope we see at some point. And then it becomes a very it could be the kind of thing where we get whatever we get from this bypass or flyby, and then 50 years, a whole generation grows up knowing, there's definitely aliens out there. There's this one thing that we saw, and, you know, hopefully we'll have another chance to see another one.
Yeah, it was, a great, great book, and actually ended up being a series, Arthur C. Clarke, Rendezvous with Rama.
Oh, I started that one, but never finished it. I'm a bad person.
You are a bad person. That dealt with, we see this thing on the outer edges of the solar system, and it's a comet. It's this. Like, wait, no, it seems to be intelligent, and it's coming into, basically, it was this alien space probe that was passing through our solar system, you know, and then heading on outwards. And we realized we had this short amount of time to interact with it before it was going to be departing. And it seemed like kind of a very realistic idea of what it could be like, you know. And it's not an invasion story. It's just this, you know, story of kind of encountering. Why don't I get the details? But it's a different
And I guess that's one of the weird things is somebody asked, you know, you go on these long drives and you start just, you know, conjecturing about stuff. And somebody said, hey, why would it matter? What would change my life if we knew for a fact that, you know, we had proof of alien civilizations? And the answer, I said, your epiphany would be exactly like a religious awakening, in that it would have tremendous meaning and not change the fact that you are supposed to be at work at 9 a.m. the next day. And so, like, for an entire generation, you know, people would just grow up like, I guess that's a thing. And then they continue to do exactly what they do.
Now, to show you kind of the precedence of just the object itself for getting this, you know, the claim, this rather outrageous claim, but fascinating. As the first known object of its type, Oumuamua presented a unique case for the International Astronomical Union, which killed Pluto, by the way, which assigns designations for astronomical objects. Originally classified as Comet C/2017U1, it was later reclassified as Asteroid A2017U1 due to the absence of a coma. They first said, it's a comet. Wait, there's no coma, so it's got to be an asteroid. Once it was unambiguously identified as coming from outside the solar system, a new designation was created, I, for interstellar object. So it went from C to A. Now it's I-2017U1, I presume. So,
hey, while we're talking about all those space telescopes out there, we'll pour one out for the inspiration of the name of the world's most boring dog. Kepler satellite finally gave up operations. Thank you for your contribution.
Well, I think it would be lovely to have more. And you know who wants more? More stuff in space, more people in space, who sees a trillion people living and working in space? It's Jeff Bezos.
Yes. Oh, really?
So we've mentioned this before, and he was recently given a forum to talk a bit more about his space ambitions, and that's one of the things he really talked about, is the idea of a trillion people living and working in space. And I can't underscore that when you have the guy who is the richest man in the world heading up the second largest publicly traded company in the world that's still growing, and this is something that he's spending. It's not, hey, I thought it would be cool that he's spending $1 billion+ a year on this effort. NASA's entire budget, something like $17 to $20 billion. So you have a guy that now is privately committing about 5% of that budget towards one goal. NASA's human space exploration budget's like 10. I mean, this is a guy that's contributing about 10% of his, you know, 10%, you know, towards one specific cause, and perhaps slightly more efficiently in its own way. I think it's a little more than, hey, this, you know, some interesting person said something kind of interesting. I mean, it's like, that's a, the bold, bold, bold vision from a guy who has proved himself.
Man, I don't want to get too heady on it, but it's like it's almost as though Jeff Bezos has been. Let me put it this way: he seems to be acting as though he's trying to think of all of humanity as a single organism, and everybody is a cell. And by efficiently getting all the cells the nutrients they need in the in terms of, you know, food and technology and even art and so on. And now he's figuring out the body of humanity now needs to bust out of this petri dish. And so that's the next thing we got to do now that we get more and more efficient so that we don't choke ourselves out on this planet.
Well, I think also it's just the we're living in a very extraordinary time where all things are kind of possible in a level that I don't think that they felt like they were possible in years past. And the current crop, you know, criticize and defame them as we are wont to do. The current crop of our kind of captains of industry, like the issues that they want to solve on their like off time, are about as ambitious as you could possibly think. And certainly we can say, oh, well, why don't you solve something else, like, you know, world hunger or something like that. But this is what they want to do. And I don't know. I mean, I don't think, can you get more ambitious than we need to become a multi-planet species?
And I want to just reinforce the idea that the more space is an amazing laboratory for research and doing this. And if you want to figure out about sustainability on Earth, when you build spacecraft and you figure out colonies and you figure out these challenges, you learn about a lot of what we learned and how to keep our astronauts alive to help us understand very small ecosystems, sustainability, things like this. The trade-offs from these are way better than building big sports stadiums or NASCAR or lipstick or having Halloween. We could cancel Halloween and provide enough food for everybody in the world or whatever. But nobody talks about that because we get those things and why they're important to us. The things that's hard for us to see, like, why is space important to me? And I'm not going to make an argument about, like, well, NASA invented Velcro, stuff like that. But there's 1,000 little things that happen from this. And anytime we have a new place in which we can research, those benefits affect us all. And I think, you know, be amazing. So we forgot to mention the passing of another big advocate for space, brain research, computing research, a really amazing person in his own right was Paul Allen. So Paul Allen passed away 2 weeks ago, who was one of the founders of Microsoft. And, you know, he was a guy who was brilliant, very, very brilliant. You read the early history of him and his, you know, one of these people, pioneers of computing and, you know, very, very talented person in many ways who happened to be at the right time, the right place, perhaps for the right, you know, boom. But he was a guy that contributed to a lot of other things. And he, one of the companies he's founded is Stratolaunch, which that's the company that wants to build the largest airplane ever to launch rockets from, because there's kind of two solutions out there. One is using boosters like SpaceX and Blue Origin does, which, you know, allow you to get in a really high altitude and then you bring the booster back down to the launch pad. Stratolaunch is saying, well, we want to use a spacecraft and we want to put the rocket into there, or excuse me, use an airplane, get the airplane to a really high altitude and let the rocket take off from there. The advantage of that is you can launch your rockets from a lot different places than just launch facilities. You can launch your rockets from long runways and you can put those runways anywhere. And you can also insert your rockets into very different orbital configurations because you can point them whatever direction you want. You can do a lot. There is a lot of value to this, and they originally were partnering with SpaceX, or SpaceX was going to put like a Falcon rocket underneath it. That stopped, I think, because SpaceX decided they wanted to focus just on booster launch. But Stratolaunch is still going strong, and just a few days ago, last week, they did the first test of the Stratolaunch, of the higher speed test of the taxiing the airplane down the runway, and, you know, it held up remarkably. And so they're building up, you know, they're getting ready to have this airplane take off.
It's really an extraordinary design. I guess I wasn't really dialed in on this project because I feel like I'm seeing it for the first time. It looks like just two 777s with the wings fused in between, six engines across. It's really extraordinarily looking.
Yeah. Yeah, this thing's huge. So, and I think they're working with, I believe, Virgin Galactic, I want to say, with our I forget who the rocket partner they're going to be working with is. I hope Strato Launch continues doing what they're doing. I think there is a use for this, and you know, things like this. You know, NASA was never going to be able to get Congress to give them the money to build something at this scale. You know, nobody's able to do this. And thanks to, you know, thanks to Paul Allen for doing this. Thanks to Jeff Bezos, who's spending, you know, he's, if we're going to have a future in space, it's going to be because of these different people who are trying different programs. And what Brian's point earlier about, let's go experiment and do stuff, even if there's a failure, you know, and it's great that these guys are using their private wealth for doing it. And I think the value from these way, you know, outweigh what other things we consider to be very good, you know. Somebody said Virgin Galactic are completely independent. Yes, but I'm trying to remember. I think there's a partnership agreement. I want to say I'm trying to remember who it is that is going to build the rocket that's going to go with it. It might be ULA or whatever, but Strato Launch has basically tried to partner with other organizations to be able to go do that. Virgin Galactic, as you know, is Richard Branson and others involved with that. And that was basically using the technology behind the spaceship or Spaceship One, which was the XPRIZE winner, which was the very, very brilliant sort of design for that. So,
By the way, one footnote on Paul Allen, just because it really struck me because of the timing. He obviously succumbed to cancer, but he was initially diagnosed with cancer in 1983. That was the year I was born.
Holy
which forced
cow.
his resignation from Microsoft. And the life he led in that intervening 35 years was just remarkable and amazing. And a figure, I think, deserving of more attention, specifically now that we know that he is no longer with us and we can kind of revere him in another context, but just an amazing guy, and apparently can shred like Jimi Hendrix. There's video.
Yeah. Oh, here's there's just update. We actually covered this on the show, which was they had tried partnering with some other companies, but then ultimately they decided to build their own vehicles, including they have a manifest, the Pegasus, a medium launch vehicle, a medium launch heavy, and then a space plane that they want to build. And so the Strato Launch is planning to build their own to do this. So, you know, and they have a several year time frame to doing that. So, and then it's Virgin Orbit. That was the separate company that's working with Virgin Galactic. So, exciting times, exciting times. On that note, any picks?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm reading your BFF's new book, Jojo Hate or Height. I forgot who the co-author is, but it's The Coddling of the American Mind. And I am so glad that I read The Righteous Mind first so that I know a bit about how he writes and where he's coming from. But it makes the case that it starts with a very good example that rings close to home for me personally, because we have two kids who have anaphylactic food allergies. And it, by the numbers, I think he said, and these numbers will be wrong because I can't remember anything, that in the early 1990s, I believe, the odds of a peanut allergy were roughly 4 in 1,000 or whatever, at which point in a good-natured or well-intentioned effort to make it easier for everyone else, a lot of preschools said, no nuts, no nuts, no nuts. And he attended the orientation and he raised his hand. He was like, hey, it'd be really helpful if we knew, does anybody here have a nut allergy or is anybody allergic to peanuts? And it was just like, no, that doesn't matter. No nuts. And then, you know, here we are 20, 30 years later and the allergy rate has quintupled, like 500% more. And now the best thinking is expose your kids, if you're able, to peanut, you know, puffed popcorn, basically, so that you can, you know, get them used to it, because absent ever having encountered peanuts, your body doesn't build up any defense for that. And so then, you know, and this is, you know, that's as the parents of kids, it's weird to sort of be a statistical footnote in that story, in that, you know, depending on the severity of the allergies, I think one of our children would have been severely allergic regardless, but the other one is a very, is a much more mild allergy. And it makes me wonder if we're not a bit of a collateral damage in that. And then, they extend the idea to how well-intentioned, policies on university campuses do things like, you know, try to protect people from being uncomfortable with, by exposure to things that trigger negative images or whatever. Specifically, that is the exact opposite advice of what full-time professional therapists give to people who have PTSD. They say, no, you absolutely must. What you do is first, if you have a significant event, first we're just going to talk about it. And so you're going to build up the strength to be able to talk about it in the abstract. And then we're going to start looking at pictures of it. And then we're going to put you in situations that are close to it. And it's like a muscle you build up. He talks a lot about Nassim Taleb's book, Anti-Fragile, and that whole concept that there are complex systems like your bones or your muscles that are, it's not that they're fragile and they could break, and it's not that they're robust in that you can slam them and they bounce around. They're anti-fragile in that the more trauma or the more, we'll say minor trauma or whatever, the more they're banged around, the stronger they get. And that's why we go to the gym to work out, is, and we increase the weight so that we can get stronger and stronger and so on. And I love the book Anti-Fragile. I would say read Anti-Fragile before you read The Coddling of the American Mind, so it doesn't sound like they're citing voodoo. But I'm about halfway through it, and it talks a lot about some of the high profile stories we've heard of campus revolts and this war of ideas over the last couple of years. It's really interesting stuff.
It's frustrating because it's like, you know, here in where I live in Burbank, they did the plastic bag ban, right? The plastic, got to get rid of plastic bags. So, you know, the ocean's filled with plastic. And it's like, okay, break that down. We find out 90-some% of the plastic in the oceans comes from basically a couple rivers in Africa and China. You know, our water system here, I don't know, I'm inland. You know, I've asked, how would a plastic bag I buy in Burbank make its way into the ocean? I'm like, well, the storm drains or this. And it's like, no, we have a problem of plastic in the ocean, which is true. And then we have these plastic bags here. In cities where they ban plastic bags, there is statistical evidence you have an increase in foodborne illnesses because now people have to use the reusable bags, which, if you keep putting fruit and things like this inside of out there, you have a higher incidence of bacteria and other, you know, these pathogens. You know, they go, well, you're supposed to wash them out. Okay, so I'm supposed to use water and soap and put that into the ecosystem. And they're bad. I mean, the ban on these is bad for humans. It's bad on it for humans, and there's no effect that it does anything to help the environment. And then we move to straws. Now we're trying to get rid of straws. Well, straws did a couple things. One of them is they help prevent tooth decay. If you're using a straw, you're getting less sugar or whatever you're doing going through your front of your dentum of your teeth. And now we're trying to do this because, well, we found a sea turtle with a plastic straw up its nose. You know, and that's the frustrating thing is that you can't, you know, you don't get to bring up the science now because you're not supposed to. And and my arguments against these things may be wrong, but there's no room for debate, you know. And you've seen, you know, the peanut allergy is a great example of one of these things where there may be more children have died now because we did this leap to let's get rid of all nuts without thinking through. Well, there's a lot of evidence like
thinking through implies that it was possible to see all this. There's been a significant amount of data that has surfaced and we've learned new things since then. It's a, you know, the crime wouldn't be not knowing what the effect would be. The crime would be to stick to a bad policy after you have the data to show that you don't want to do that.
Or, I mean, I would say that there's been a lot of the research as far as how we develop our resistance to things was there before a lot of these places started banning peanuts. That was there before. And there were people who've been worried about, like, you know, we've known about farm kids have fewer allergies than city kids, and farm kids are exposed to everything. And the idea of, like, let's completely eliminate exposures, I understand the intention, but the fact that the misapplication of the precautionary principle, and that's my frustration there, is we're still banning, where cities are still now moving to ban plastic bags and straws. They're like, wait, no, this is what the science says. Nobody wants to listen to the science because they're already, you know,
I guess
have
this become beholden. This is the eternal optimist in me, is that I hear all that and I'm like, yeah, no, that is a bummer. But those are great natural experiments for economists. Like, there's going to be really good data that comes as a result of each of these things.
Sure, you know, and like I'm, you know, I get frustrated. You walk into a bathroom and there are no paper towels because the environment.
I lose my mind over that, dude. Like a disease spraying garbage factories. Oh my God. Like, at some point I heard by a hand washing expert on, I want to say like Good Morning America, this must've been 20 years ago, that just wiping your hands on a paper towel gets you most of the way to clean. Like you can get, I think she said 90%. I don't know if that's true or not, but like just wiping on the most important part of the entire thing is the paper towel.
And now you have bathrooms that one have, you have to grab the door handle to leave. And it's like, great. I just washed my hands. The guy that left 10 seconds before me, I heard this horrible sound coming from the John and he just went straight to the door and grabbed that handle. I've got to grab that handle now. I've got to grab this handle. What did your air dryer do? Nothing. It's like, I get frustrated with no paper. Like, how am I supposed to, like, I'm not like Mr. Fussy. Oh, no germs. It's like, it's science. But anyhow.
I'm really enjoying it. It's a wonderful lens to view everything through, and you learn a bit about CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. You learn a bit about anti-fragility. It's fun. You know, I'm like 3 or 4 years into my quest to just constantly be reading nonfiction books, and it's so fun. When you to hear one book quoting another book, I'm like, oh yeah, no. I read that. I read that one. Read that other one. Oh no, that's a good way to combine those two, and so on.
Yeah. I got a recommendation I'll give to you later from Jack Horner, dinosaur guy. I ran into him Saturday, and he mentioned a book he was very keen on.
This is in between hanging out with JoJo.
Yeah, if you run into JoJo and you bring up my name and he pretends like, it's just a game we play. Just a game. So.
Classic JoJo.
Yeah. Justin?
I've started watching a show that Brian has been very eager for me to watch because we both very much enjoy it, and it is Preacher from AMC. I am, I think, 6 or 7 episodes in. It continues to be one of my favorite shows on television. And it's just so fantastic that we get to have one of my favorite comics adapted as faithfully in its tone and not necessarily in its story. But man, is it just one of those shows where, there's never a moment when you turn around the corner that what you find is not more colorful, creative, and inventive than you were expecting it. It is a show that hangs its hat on its ability to continue to surprise you in, and obviously, look, this is a show that delights in how far it can go. It amazes me that it has not. It's now 3 seasons in, and the way that they take Catholic the world of the Bible and make it their science fantasy playground with just these characters being tossed around all willy-nilly in crazy ways. Like, man, it is amazing that it has not been protested or picketed, but I am glad that it continues to exist for those that enjoy it.
When you say 6 episodes in, you're talking about of the 3rd season or 2nd season?
Oh, 3rd season.
Third season, yeah.
The most recent season. I'm now catching up on the most recent season. But this season finds... And look, this is kind of the blessing and the curse of the television version is that the show is the comic was very much an on the road story. So it's like every different town, different characters, different adventures. The show tends to kind of stick the characters, our central 3 characters in different settings, many of which echo the biggest moments of the comic book, but this season brings us back to a little bit of Jesse Custer's backstory, our main character. And man, it's just one of those things where you look at other shows that, and maybe Lost was kind of the breaking point on this in television where the flashback became this thing that you dreaded, where it was like, oh God, like everything doesn't need to be explained. Like, why do we have to string out like, oh, how are we going to make them finding this bullfrog a whole episode? Oh, because we're going to spend half the episode in this dumb backstory about how somebody was really sleeping with the girl at Starbucks until they found out that she was actually a spy or something. Like, it was just some dumb little bottle episode, but you don't want to do a bottle episode, so you call it a backstory. And Preacher is a show where, granted, you can go a lot more places when the place you're at is a house of magic and voodoo, but there's just so much fun in what they're building up, and it just shows you why, like, a backstory isn't a problem in writing. Boring backstories are. Backstories that don't connect are, and Preacher is never guilty of that.
Bryce?
I finished Bodyguard last night on Netflix. I think Brian maybe recommended this last week. It's only six episodes, but man, it's a real good action thriller about a former soldier with PTSD turned bodyguard of a very what would they call her? A ambitious
of politician. The walking embodiment of everything he hated about the politicians who put him in the war.
Yeah. This was the pick last time, right?
Right.
Yeah. So
I finally finished. Did you get to finish it?
No, I didn't. Between production and everything, it didn't happen. The big problem is it's good enough that now it's on the can't watch without Bonnie list, and then That changes everything. It changes everything.
Cool. The last episode is like extra long. It's like 78 minutes or something. But man, a lot of good tension, and it all wraps up in there's a point like in the fourth or fifth episode where you're like, oh, okay, well, big things have stopped happening, so we're just going to be focusing on this one thing for a while. But the last episode really like pulls it all together, gets everything sorted out. The high tension, things are going back and forth. It's really good. That's Bodyguard on Netflix. So I think it's on the iPlayer if you're in England.
Yeah, it was originally a BBC production.
Right.
Just a funny little button to Justin's comment about flashbacks. The one that broke everybody for Lost and like the bottle stories that went nowhere was, remember Nikki and Paolo? In Lost,
sure.
The couple, yeah. We had no idea who they were or whatever.
Oh, yeah, we started to develop them, and then suddenly they're just they're dead or paralyzed and just die there. And
yeah,
that was their solution after realizing this was a horrifying mistake.
So do you know what Paolo, what you've seen Paolo in more recently?
Well, I know he was Xerxes in 300.
Another show that's known for its flashbacks and way out of sequence, Westworld, Hector Eschaton.
Oh, yes, yes,
the
yes.
The bad
yes.
boy, you know, the bad boy cowboy. That's him.
Yes. Wow.
Good thing he didn't learn his lesson because it worked out really well for him.
It did. No,
flashback shows. Oh, we have the script from HBO. Oh, no.
He says, no, no. And they're like, have you seen the costume you get to wear? And you're like, all right.
I see.
So I have a pick. First off, I'm going to say, like, I've got the AMC, whatever their version of the movie pass thing is. That's the $20 a month. You can see like three or four movies a week.
By the way, they love that you call it that.
You use the app.
They hope everyone refers to it as the AMC, whatever, like movie pass thing.
but real, three movies a week. They in any format, anything you want. There are no restrictions on it. They just announced they have 500,000 subscribers to it.
Wow.
So. And I use it because sometimes there's a movie. It's like, I don't know. All right, I'll go see it. And I saw Halloween Before, which I really dug. And then last night, I was like, man, I don't know. My girlfriend really wanted to see it. I'm like, I don't know if it's gonna be good. The critics trashed it. Whatever. Let me go see. And I went and saw Bohemian Rhapsody.
Uh huh.
And I would say that there are, from my critical point of view, suffers a lot of biopic flaws. There's a lot of the tropes and stuff you're going to see. And this was also a movie that was, you know, Brian May is one of the producers of it, you know, one of the founding members of Queen. So you know that it's going to be, you're going to get a little dirt, but not a lot of dirt, because it's, you know, basically made by the people who it's about. So, well, with the exception of Freddie Mercury. And I got to tell you that I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. And it was, you know, one, it's people have accused it, like, one description, like, oh, I wrapped it in bubble wrap and sort of, you know, it's superficial and it doesn't get to this. And I thought about this, like, some biopics are designed, almost feel like they're designed to make you not like the person that you look up to, you know? Yeah. And I would say this is the different, this is certainly, there's, this is a, the Disney version, I guess. I mean, not say that, like, I'm gonna get into, you know, Freddie Mercury's personal life, sex life, all this sort of stuff. I mean, is Disney sort of like, let's create a simple version of the story. Let's get rid of contradictory things. We're going to consolidate characters into people that didn't exist. We're going to do things just to tell you this sort of story. And understand that you're watching a movie that uses the same names and characters, some of the events, but it's not really what happened in that sort of way. But that being said, about the music, about the band, about Freddie Mercury, I really enjoyed it. Really, really enjoyed it. Thought I was really good. And, you know, I would say it's kind of like the anti-Steve Jobs movie, where that felt like that was, you know, Sorkin deciding to, oh, you like this guy. Well, let me show you who he really was. Like, you didn't know. I mean, you used a book written by a guy that hastily put it out there. And I'm not any closer to knowing who this guy is. I know what your sock puppet is like. And this is sort of maybe like that, but on the other side of the spectrum. You're going to come out of here, you know, going like, man, Queen was a great band. Freddie Mercury had a great voice. What an interesting life. So.
Well, yeah, and that's look, it's done very well at the box office. It mm-hmm. opened a 50 million opening weekend. So obviously people have kind of resonated with it. And even some of the critical reviews that I read were very much like, hey, look, at the end of the day, Queen made some really great songs. So it's like, this is just, yeah, even if it was a Punch and Judy puppet show that was punctuated by all these Queen songs, you'd probably be, you know, it's going to be a good cable movie, just because it's always a good excuse to listen to a bunch of Queen songs.
Well, it's a movie where you have, if you look at the critics put it, like the Tomatometer put it at 60%. The audience score right now is 95%.
Wow.
It's got a cinema score in it. So the audiences are loving this movie. You compare it to the Steve Jobs movie where critics loved it, but audiences came out of it like, this isn't what I wanted, you know, and this isn't, I didn't get the story that I wanted. And I think it's a very, you know, everything's going to have its own bias. Everything's going to have its own thing. But if you love Queen and you know, think Freddie Mercury was an amazing talent, go see this movie. You're not going to hear anything you didn't already know before.
Yeah.
You're going to see a great story, you know, a great story presented in a pretty good way.
And Rami Malek credible as Freddie?
Oh, he's great. But I would say that, like, the kind of the big surprise is John Deacon is played by Joseph Mazzello.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do.
Oh, okay.
Kid from Jurassic Park.
Oh, wait, the little kid?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Kid from Jurassic Park.
Wow.
He plays John Deacon, who is the very reclusive member of Queen, who has pretty much, after Freddie Mercury passed away, pretty much almost all but stopped performing. Still involved with Queen behind the scenes, but he's just, you know, a very, very reclusive person. But so that was Joseph Mazzello playing it. But yeah, Rami Malek's great. The charisma that he had, you're like, this is just, I'm like, so glad they didn't do the Sacha Baron Cohen version. He was at one time was going to play him. And I think that this was Rami Malek just, I feel bad because the controversy behind the scenes between, you know, Singer leaving the project, still getting director's credit, everything else like this, the climate in the town around him, I hope it doesn't affect, you know, Rami Malek when it comes to award season, whatever, because I thought he did an amazing job.
Wow.
Well, and look, people love biopics. There's a reason why it had that, like, that Oscar run for a while, where with, like, Ray and Walk the Line and everything. It's a crowd pleasing genre. And
you mean the movies about how entertainers are important, and it's important that entertainers entertain?
Well, but yes, and at least those are the musician ones, and not, they don't go fully up their butt with the, like, oh, with what a great actress,
acting,
or what a great actor somebody was, or what a great director somebody was. Like,
right.
That's what, you know, or it's just how great LA is. You can always count for at least 2 out of the 10 best picture movies about how great LA is.
Yeah. It's amazing. Guess that's it, gentlemen. We've just got an interplanetary object in our solar system that may be of alien origin.
NBD. We also talked about movies. That was fun.
True that. Go to the theaters, enjoy movies while you can. Hold your family close. Until the next episode of Weird Things. It's been weird.
Club hopes you have enjoyed this broadcast.